So, Minister of Information.
Minister of Information, yeah. That was great. And, I mean, we organized three conferences. We got press attention in the city in Halifax and, to a certain extent, elsewhere in the province. We tried to build links with other organizations, not very successfully, because they just weren't interested. And I can understand why, from a real politic point of view. What was it going to benefit the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor, for instance, to have any connection with us? Right? I mean, that was just one of the groups. I shouldn't mention them by name, but that was just one of the groups that didn't have anything to do with us. Hmm. But
what about Mi'kmaq?
The Mi'kmaq or Mi'kmaq people, the ones we were involved with, were very supportive. There was a lot of solidarity. Well, for one thing, this is another point to bring up, but for one thing, even though it's not a subject that people talk about very much, we're intertwined. I mean, not utterly, not completely, but I know in my own family, yes, definitely. My grandfather was part Mi'kmaq. I don't think he didn't raise his children with a Mi'kmaq identity, and I certainly wasn't either. But there are relatives of mine who you can see very clearly just from a very, you know, just looking at them, you can see, hey, there's Indian there. And that's another subject which I'm really fascinated by, the fact that the Black Native, Black Aboriginal African / Aboriginal connection in Canada, at least on the East Coast, has never really been explored. They're only starting to explore those connections in the U.S. now, or have been over the last decade, but we have had no real exploration of those connections on the East Coast. And it's interesting because just from, no one in my family is interested, for instance, in going and getting our status and so on and so forth, but it's a real possibility. You know, it's a serious possibility. I know of at least one other, as I would say, Africadian, Black Nova Scotian gentleman who's a writer. In fact, Peter A.B. Bailey, or Peter Bliss Bailey, who now lives in Montreal. And Peter now identifies himself as a Mi'kmaq, but he started off as a Black writer. You know, and this is fascinating. So, I mean, that's a long and kind of rambling answer to the question, but yeah, there was always a lot of support there, back and forth, and so that was one group where we could really experience some solidarity. But I mean, oh God, this is bringing back memories. I remember that when we were trying to get things going with multiculturalism, official multiculturalism in Halifax, some of the folks, I'm not going to name any names here, but some of the folks who were involved in the multiculturalism movement were, in my mind, or our minds, it wasn't just my feeling, but some of us Black youth had the sense that they were part of the problem and not part of the solution, because they were interested in kind of identifying with a kind of ethnic, celebrating ethnic difference, but not examining the question of racism, not at all. That was too disruptive. It would get into questions of class, privilege, et cetera, et cetera. And the people we were associating with who were part of that movement back then did not want any part of that. What they wanted us to do was come and sing our spirituals, but don't talk about racism, don't talk about employment equity, and don't talk about anything that is going to upset other people who are part of this coalition, in quotation marks. So actually, we found there was one experience we had with a youth multiculturalism conference. I'll never forget it, because we went there. Okay, we were all sort of budding Marxists at this point. So we went there trying to get some issues on the table, and we got shut down. We got shut down so much that we spent the rest of that conference deliberately singing spirituals, because we felt oppressed. We felt oppressed. So we were like, okay. Exactly. I remember that very well. We just felt so, like, just shut out of this whole discussion that... And also, to a certain extent, again, this was 79, 80 people. We also felt that there was an attempt by the Liberal Party, who were, of course, in power at that point federally, to just use us for votes, because everybody knew an election was coming in 79, 5 years into Trudeau's third mandate. So we all knew, hey, there's an election coming, and that's why we're having all these multiculturalism festivals, et cetera, et cetera. I got flown to Ottawa a couple of times to take part in these multiculturalism gatherings, etc. And it was clear that it was not serious. It was just about liberal wallpaper. We were going to be wallpaper for the Liberal Party for election platforms. That was it. And it was really clear when they came to Halifax and did this youth conference, it was very clear what was going on. So, again, apart from The Mi'kmaqs, there really wasn't a whole lot of solidarity we had with other people at that conference. And in fact, the Native position was really sensible, because theirs was, we have nothing to do with multiculturalism. You know, we're here to make that point. We want nothing to do with it. We have nothing to do with it. You know, this is the settlers talking about how to divide up the pie. And so it's like, okay, and as far as we were concerned, wow. You know, that was a pretty sensible course, very sensible position, given our feelings at the, at that time. But, you know, there were some people in the multiculturalism movement back then who were pretty good. Dr. Pichai, who is himself an expert in black history, Bridglal Pichai, we all called him Bridge. He had an interesting history. He's published a book about his life called My Africa, My Canada. And but Bridge Pichai was professor of development, I think international development, at St. Mary's University. He hired me in the summer of 1978 to be a multiculturalism outreach worker. One of those liberal projects, right? So it was fun. But he was really serious, very scholarly. He put together a conference on black Canadian history and produced a volume of papers from that conference. Rocky took part in it as well. That was something else that was going on at the same time we were trying to organize the black youth organization. So I've been rambling, but
this is all sailing.
You know, how do I put it? At this time in my life, we had the whole black youth organizational thrust, the multiculturalism thing that was coming about, and then this sort of flirtation with Marxism. All happening at the same time. And as a result of that, not only did I get to travel around Nova Scotia, I got to go to Toronto, to Winnipeg, to Montreal. I remember those trips really well because they all happened about 2 weeks apart. And by every mode of transportation imaginable, plane, train, bus, and car. I went to Montreal for a Marxist conference, which I remember very well. It was en lutte, in struggle. The strugglers, we like to call them. The strugglers had come to Halifax. I mean, it was. I mean, I'm jumping all over the place here, but back in '78, again, I think there was Mountie money there somewhere under the table. But in any event, we had about three or four serious, diehard Marxist groups active in Halifax, different types, and of course, all hating each other's guts, right? Because that factionalism was very important. In any event, they were all there, and I sort of like floated around, not giving my support to any one particular group too much, but sort of like just floating around and trying to get support from all of them. And they were supportive because they wanted to co-opt us, probably, right?
No doubt.
So, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, but it was interesting because I did get to, when I made a car trip to Montreal for En Lutte's general meeting or general gathering. And all these groups were actually from Quebec. All of them were. Because of the referendum, for crying out loud. I mean, this is an interesting moment, because everybody knew there's going to be this referendum, and the federal government was doing everything it could, especially when Trudeau came back, but even before he was defeated in 79, they're doing everything they could to prepare the way for a federalist victory. And that meant, I think, without any evidence at all, I think that meant trying to tie up people on the left as much as possible. And so all of the extremists or people who might be extremists were all fighting each other about should Quebec separate or not, what kind of leader, is it a bourgeois thing, is it really populist, blah, blah, blah. You know, people were involved in all these kinds of debates in Halifax, right? So it was interesting because you had any Haligonian might have thought, I want to go there and show my solidarity with Quebecois and bring about the separation of Quebec. We're fighting these other Marxists in Halifax. So, you know, that's why I think the whole thing was just a put up, because after the referendum happened, all those groups basically shriveled up and disappeared. They just, boom, gone. History. You know, within a couple of years of 1980, they were finished, over with, kaput. And, you know, that just makes me think that, oh, that's a very interesting coincidence. Maybe it's because they felt, okay, there's nothing more to fight about because there won't be another referendum. But that doesn't make sense. If you're a real Marxist group, why disappear after the referendum's over? You know, there's still a revolution to be waged. But in any event, while they were around, all four of them, combating and fighting, it was exciting. It was exciting to sort of be a fellow traveler with four different groups. And then going to Montreal at one time. That was fun. And I wrote a poem on that trip on the way back, which is still one of my personal favorites. and confirmed to me that I was a poet. And the same thing for another trip out to Winnipeg. I met Sam Selvin because they put on, there was this Black Writers Collective meeting in Winnipeg in March 79, and Sylvia Hamilton was supposed to go, the filmmaker, who was also my babysitter. I forgot to mention that. Yeah. Sylvia Hamilton was my babysitter. But in any event, I don't remember her babysitting me, but she told me that. I met her when I was 18 as well. I mean, it's funny. You know, I mean, I got to know her as a older person when I was 18. She was known as the black hippie kind of thing in North End Hellfest, because she was still wearing the long skirts and, you know, I mean, she didn't really, you know, she was just really funky, down to earth, and I should have mentioned her sooner, because she was also, along with Rocky and Walter, she was also extremely influential for me when I was 18, 19, because many of those weekends when I was living in Halifax, many weekends during that year, 78, 79, I'd go out to her house that she shared with her then partner, now husband, Bev Greenlaw, and we would sit up half the night, because they'd already been through all this stuff. I mean, Sylvia was born 10 years ahead of me. She was born in 1950 again. She went through the 60s, so here I am saying, yeah, but Malcolm was right. And she was like, well, you know, okay, but, right? So it was like, again, there I was being re-educated, or being educated. The other important thing about Sylvia was she was out front nonconformist. Absolutely. That's why people call her a hippie, because she was nonconformist, utterly. She was feminist. She probably was just a little bit socialist. I think she was, although she never really made that a big part of her, where she was coming from. I mean, she had respect for it, but she wouldn't really, she was not into that. I mean, that's not the right way to put it. What am I trying to say? She was definitely into popular organization. It wasn't anything that was going on in the community that Sylvia was not involved with. So she supported us in the Central Planning Committee. She supported any community endeavor to do anything at all that was progressive, anything at all. But she had no ideological, and would not take any kind of ideological stance, per se. Except, we got to make things better, and I'll do whatever is necessary to make things better. Because of the fact that she'd already been through all that. She already got through all that. So it was like, when I would talk to her about the En Loop people, the strugglers, she would say, oh yeah, the strugglers.
Look patient.
Yeah, and look very patient. It's like, yeah, okay. But the other thing is, like I mentioned, Rocky's library, she had a library. And she also had a house, on again with Bev, on Maynard Street, that at first they just had the top part, then they had the whole house. And then it was like, George, anytime you want to come and stay, please do. They would put on all kinds of rice and peas, tea. I remember one Christmas, she gave me a big can of Earl Grey tea. Because I brought them by a funk record. I forget, I think it was Gil Scott Heron, actually. I brought them a Gil Scott Heron record. She said, oh, okay, thank you very much. Now, here, you have some, take this. So I think she gave me a can of English breakfast tea and a can of Earl Grey tea. And that's how I got to know Earl Grey tea. I mean, the thing about Sylvia was that she was already in the world. You know, she did her BA university at Acadia University. She was working as a reporter, a journalist, and really trying hard. And it was hard for a black woman to be doing that, to be a journalist in Halifax. But you see, like, Sylvia was connected to Walter, to Joan, to women's movement, to the environmental movement. I mean, everything that was progressive that was going on in the city, she was part of it. She was there with her husband as well. And so when I'd go to their place again, we would just have these tremendous conversations that would last until 3 o'clock in the morning. And they would be very patient listening to me go on, go on. And then they'd say, hey, don't bother walking up to your house, you know, even though it was only 2 blocks away. It was only 2 blocks away, but it'd be like 3 o'clock in the morning. Say, just sleep here. Just sleep here. And, you know, pull out the futon and say, here you go. And I'd get up in the morning, and then we'd do more conversation, and lots more discussion about poetry and art and music. What was going on in the world? I mean, just general stuff back then. So again, it's really funny. Now I know I see Sylvia, filmmaker, doing all kinds of films, and sometimes we're in the same kind of venues, and I'll get up and say, it's my pleasure to introduce Sylvia Hamilton, used to babysit me. embarrassing her all the time. All the time. Right?
Well, that's so, the role of the baby sat.
That's it. Yeah. So that was funny. So anyway, it was a really, really interesting little group of people in Halifax back then. I mean, one other thing they all shared in common, Rocky, Walter, Sylvia, Joan, and myself, ultimately, and David Woods, we all worked for the Black United Front, and we all had to leave. Well, all of us, we all had to leave. I think Rocky got fired. Sylvia quit. Walter got fired. I was there when Walter got fired. Wasn't working for them, but I was hanging around. David Woods got fired. Our problem was we kept wanting Buck, which was provincially funded, it was federally funded. In fact, it was set up in part deliberately by Trudeau. He deliberately set it up. This is a fact, proven by cabinet documents. He deliberately set it up because he didn't want to see a Black Panther movement in Halifax or in Nova Scotia. So he said, okay, let's give these folks $100,000 and tell them to do community development. And we'll let the RCMP spy on them too at the same time, which is what they did. And this became public knowledge back in 95. We used to joke all the time about hearing clicks on Rocky's phone because he was the one. The RCMP had him under surveillance for I don't know how long, how many years. But that all came out in the House of Commons in 1995. And finally became public. But everybody knew, if you made a phone call from Rocky's and Jones, you're going to be in somebody's file forever. But anyway, they all worked for the Black United Front at one point, and it all moved on because the Black United Front was a very conservative organization because it was government funded. I mean, they did do some good things. They did some very good things, but they were very much controlled by that government dollar, which made perfect sense, because why would the government really be funding a group to embarrass them all the time? So anybody who wanted to do anything in the community, we all ended up working for Buff. We all did, and we all left or got fired. it was an amazing, I'm sorry the organization is gone, because I think it was a very important organization. It was a training school. We all got trained there. How to get fired.
Yeah.
That reminds me. I mean, one other thing that, I shouldn't even mention this, but I'm going to mention it anyway.
Always covered later.
I don't think I'll get in any trouble for it now. When I was involved, this is really, this is an amazing thing. Okay, I did my year as a student newspaper editor, and I came back to Halifax. This was 85, 86. And actually, it was 1985. I came back to Halifax, had my honors BA in English, and I couldn't get a job. Funny thing. Couldn't get a job. And I ended up doing all kinds of menial things. In fact, I went from being a newspaper editor, an imprint had, we had printed 15,000 copies weekly, right? And it was a fairly good sized little newspaper. So I went from doing that to one of the jobs I got when I got back to Halifax was stuffing inserts in the Chronicle, Herald, and the Old Star paper twice a week, minimum wage, 8 hours a night, from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. It was the strangest shift, strangest hours. But I did that, and I did it happily. And I was wondering, there were other people, of course, were there. There's one guy who had been there for like 30 years, right? Those hours, stuffing the advertising supplements in the paper. It was assembly line work. I'd never done that kind of work before, even though it was very unskilled labor. But I got a lot of respect for those older guys who were like, psh, 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 psh. I was like, let me get the paper inside the paper. It was amazing. Then I got a job working, painting the decks of a Canadian Navy ship. And that was grueling. And also, labor, unskilled labor. You didn't really have to know how to use a paintbrush. It was just slap it on, But I was happy to have both jobs because happily I had a good friend who just said, hey, you can use this apartment, no problem. So I didn't have to worry about a place to live. And I just managed to survive. And then all of a sudden, it was really bizarre. I got two job offers on the same day. One to work as a newspaper reporter with the Daily News of Halifax. And the other one was to work for the Black United Front. Now, the problem was this. The Daily News gave me 1 week to get a car because you had to be able to have a car. And I asked and begged, do I really have to have a car? And the editor, who was Lyndon Lyndon Watkins, who started Frank, He founded Frank Magazine. He hired me off the street. I just walked in. He asked me a few questions, said, okay, you're hired. And I said, he said, I'll give you 1 week to find a car. And so, okay, that was interesting. Then I went to, I had my interview with Black United Front, and they offered me a job back in my own home territory where I was, in fact, born. Although I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Halifax, and that's the Annapolis Valley. But I always loved Annapolis Valley. And so I was like, oh, wow, this is good. And Buff gave me 2 weeks. They gave me 2 weeks to find a car. Now, the real truth of the matter is this. I didn't even have a driver's license. Let alone get a car. I didn't even have a driver's license. So I had to go to work. I went to Windsor, Nova Scotia, where I have Hansport, actually, where I have an uncle. My uncle Sock. And he taught me how to drive in 2 weeks. Taught me how to drive. And then I had a cousin who sold me her car for $300. And it wasn't much of a car.
They wanted you to get a job.
It wasn't much of a car. Yeah, they wanted me to get a job. Well, it was extremely nice of her. Because even though it wasn't, the car was totally rusted out. It was just a real bucket of boats. And it was ready to fall apart. And it did constantly, consistently, every single time. But it was still really good of her to sold me her car. The only car she had. So I started working for Buff. Now, back in those days, the law was, I had my beginner's license, of course. I'd gotten that. But then you had to have somebody with a license to drive with you in order to drive legally. So luckily, I had another cousin who was unemployed. So I was able to pay him $50 of my $150 a week salary to drive with me. And so, in fact, my boss at Buff was always wondering, why is that guy always with you every time you go somewhere, right? And I just made up the story. He said, yeah, well, blah, blah, blah. He's my cousin, and he's out of work, and all that, right? So, but anyway, so we were booming up and down the Annapolis Valley all the time. And luckily, we had plenty of places, people who were willing to billet us. So that's what we did. That. But anyway, ended up working for Buff, 86, into 86. And, oh, yeah, I almost forgot. I got involved in a murder case. Involving a gentleman by the name of Graham Cromwell, who I'd known. I'd met him back in 1978 and then again in 79. And Graham was shot and killed in June 85, just after I'd gotten back to Nova Scotia. And I knew his family, and I knew him. And then I started hearing rumors from people down in his neck of the woods, a place called Weymouth Falls, black community, goes back to Loyalist times. And about how they felt that it was a murder, and how they thought that the guy who did it, who happened to be white, was going to be exonerated, was going to be acquitted from the charge that he had, which was manslaughter. And so it was really funny. I ended up getting this job with Buff in the fall of 1985, and one of the first things I did was drive to Weymouth Falls and get involved with people there who were trying to get an appeal in the case. And so we ended up forming a group called the Weymouth Falls Justice Committee. And I worked with them for closely. I mean, every weekend I was down there. So we had demonstrations in Halifax. We got all the people who'd been involved in the Central Planning Committee came over to the woodwork again, Rocky, Sylvia, blah, blah, blah. And we got things going. We had demonstrations. Some of the old Marxists who were still around, who were real Marxists, came out to give us support. David Woods was there. So we had 3 demonstrations in Halifax that got a lot of media attention. We had a demonstration in Weymouth Falls that made it onto the national with CBC. But we didn't get our appeal, which is no surprise. We even got Ann Derrick represented us, who ended on later become a big constitutional lawyer out of Halifax. Won lots and lots of cases, very progressive lawyer. But she represented us for free, pro bono. And the closest we got was a meeting with the Attorney General. And the deceased fellow's mother came to meet the Attorney General. It's one of the things that we wanted to see happen. So she did. That was Ron Giffen, the Attorney General of the day. We didn't change anything in the end. I mean, in a sense, except that we did make it an issue that, yeah, the black community is not happy, to put it mildly, about people always being shot, murdered, and the people who do it getting away with it. So at least as far as that went, we made it an issue and got it into some kind of public discussion. At the same time I was involved in that matter, Which also, I have to say, led to the writing of Wyler Falls.
I was just going to say, I looked it up on the map. I know where it is.
Yeah. Wyler Falls, I mean, started in 85. It started in 85 with me writing a series of poems about people I was meeting in Weymouth Falls and about the fellow, Graham, and who later became the model for my Othello, and his family and other people in the community. But then all those other little black communities I was doing social work in, all up and down the Annapolis Valley. I was hearing lots and lots of interesting stories from people all up and down the Annapolis Valley. And this was interesting for me because at Waterloo, I think I studied formally in class only two black poets in the entire 4 years I was there, because all the courses I had in English literature tended to be British literature. I had no courses in American lit. I had a couple in Canadian. There was one course that was a post-colonial course taught by Eric McCormick, which was very, very good. And he did have African and Caribbean writers in his class, but no poets. So the only two black poets that I formally studied. And that was because I wanted to study them my first year English class at Waterloo. But in any event, the darndest thing is I had two courses where I ended up reading one course in the summer of 81 on the Cavalier poets and Renaissance English poets, not Shakespeare. And I loved it. I really loved it. And I especially liked Paradise Lost, which I also read three times, including twice that summer, and not just because of the class, because I liked it. Really bizarre. So then I leave all that. I come to, oh yeah, because of the Paradise Lost experience, I ended up experimenting with iambic pentameter. And I wrote lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of really bad, dreadful iambic pentameter verse. Awful. I just really unadulteratedly bad stuff. 3 years worth of it. And then I went home to Nova Scotia, ended up working in the black community, and started hearing stuff that didn't sound to my ears all that different from the Renaissance poetry I've been reading. And so that started to move into, I guess the blank verse I'd been writing started to take on this other vocabulary and this other style of speech that I was hearing from the black people I was working with in the Annapolis Valley. And I found that really exciting. I could start feeling that this is my voice and this is my heritage that I'm finally beginning to address. But I know it wasn't all that specific in my mind. It was just like, wow, these are really interesting voices that I'm hearing. Voices I've grown up with, but I hadn't really paid that kind of attention to before. And so then I was always walking around taking down what people were saying around me, just writing down anything people said that I thought was interesting and trying to make poems based on the stories they were telling me and so on. So that was going on. And in the course of that year, 85, 86, I also decided that I really needed to go and do my MA. And so then I went to Dalhousie. I applied to Acadia, but they didn't have any money for me. I was accepted. They had no money for me. But Dalhousie did. And so I ended up going there, starting there in the fall of 86, and I quit my job at Black United Front. But they did ask me to stay on and become their newsletter editor, which was fun. So I said, great, I'll do that. And we started a little newsletter called The Rap, R-A-P, The Rap. But while I was working on that, in between time, I was studying at Dell, and I had two courses that were particularly interesting. One course taught by Patricia Monk on Canadian poetry, and we did a different Canadian poet every week. And it was a three-hour class. I think we met once a week, and it was an interesting class, very good class. And I just got to read a lot, and that's where I first read Michael Ondaatje. And I just loved Clapperworks of Billy the Kid, and I decided I'd do my MA thesis on him, and did. But the other course I took that I thought was really good, it was also a year-long course. I think Monk's class was only one term. I don't remember for sure, but I think it may have only been for one term. But the course I took that didn't last the whole year was John Fraser's course. The title of the course was Tradition and Experimentation in Modern Poetry, 1880 to 1920. And what I liked about it as well is he had, in his little blurb, little description of the course, he had stated that this course should be especially valuable for poets. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting, a professor who's saying that poets should take his class. So I did. We met once a week, Monday nights, Fraser's house, with his artist wife, Carol Horn Fraser, serving us coffee and cookies about halfway through the three-hour class. I was always consistently late, not getting there until 7:30 or so. No, it hasn't changed. We were started at 7. We were supposed to go until 10. But I have to say, that was the most rewarding, the most stimulating, the most provocative, the most interesting class I had ever had. And throughout all of my university years, from undergraduate to PhD, it was the most fascinating. And the reason why was because, for whatever reasons, and even Fraser, and he and I are good friends, and he says that year was the best year he ever had. Now, it was really strange. It was just a mix of personalities in the class.
Yeah, yeah. It happens. Yeah.
And there were a few of us were poets. Laura McLaughlin's published one book. She was in that class. Suzanne Alexander, who's attached to Goose Lane Editions now, was in that class. Oh, yeah, there was one person whose name I forget now who started a publishing company called Bushek Books. New publishing company has been around for a few years, publishing short fiction and poetry, but she came out of that class. So it was a really interesting little mix of people. And I also loved Fraser's approach to things. And he wouldn't lecture. It was certainly a seminar class, the most seminary in a class I've ever been in, because he really would not say much. It was basically, he would assign, we all had to choose a topic at the beginning of the year. Beginning of each term, we had to choose which topic we would work on. And the first term, what we were responsible for was we had to produce one paper, hand it in with enough time in advance to let the other members of the class read it and discuss it and give feedback on it, and just come to class. I don't know how it happened, but I ended up drawing Baudelaire for the first term. Fall 86.
Oh my.
Because he insisted that I really had to deal with French metrics. And I mean, like, I'm like scared. It's like, what do I know? I'm not even any good at French. I mean, how am I supposed to do French meter? Right? But I worked my butt off in that paper. I did. I ended up writing it two nights straight, staying up, pulling all-nighters with a bottle of rum in the Black and Decker front office. I slept on the floor because I wanted to write a good paper. I had to write a good paper because I knew there were only two papers in that class. I had to have a good paper. So I got all the books and papers I could find on Baudelaire, and I wrote a good paper. I dropped it off. Never forget, I took a taxi over because the buff office was in Dartmouth. I took a taxi over to Fraser's house Sunday morning. He had to be there Sunday morning. I dropped an envelope at his front door. Got back in the cab, went to the apartment I was living in at the time, and went to bed. That, I think it was like 9 a.m. in the morning, and I didn't get up again until 7 p.m. I mean, it was the craziest time. And I was like shaking when I went to his house the next night to get the, not he, he wouldn't, his evaluation was if he liked it, he would nod. That, yes, nodding meant that it was good. So he was consistently nodding. So I thought, oh, okay, glad I got through that. That was really good. But the other thing that was really nice about that class was the fact that, was because he just insisted that we just had to talk. It had to be a lot of discussion. And the first term, despite the fact I did a reasonable job in that Baudelaire essay, I was really scared. I was really shy because there were students in the class who were PhD students. And I thought, oh my God, how can I... I don't know anything about deconstruction. How can I say anything? So I was like completely silent. I would just sit there and listen. But the next term, I had the bad luck of getting the topic of free verse for my paper. The term beginning in January. And again, Fraser was not deliberately unhelpful in trying and giving directions about what you should be trying to do in the paper on free verse. And I freaked out. I couldn't figure out how to write the paper. I did write something, but I knew it wasn't really good. I knew that. And he nodded a couple times that night that the paper came in, and people were actually, my fellow students in the class, They were great. They were like, yeah, good paper, nice job. But I knew that it wasn't. I knew that I'd missed the thrust of the thing. I just hadn't gotten a handle on it. So Fraser gave me back the paper a couple days later, and it was full of notes, basically suggesting that you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you missed this, you missed that. So I went to meet with him and said, I asked him, well, you know, what do you really think of it? Because he hadn't put a grade on it. And he asked me, what do you think of it? And I said, well, it's not a very good paper. And he said, yeah. So I'm forgetting all into all this minutiae about that. But then I was really scared because I'd done one good paper and then there was like one that wasn't so good. And this was an important course for me as a poet. So I thought, I've just got to do better. So I said, look, can I do another paper for you? He said, no. So just keep coming to class and we'll see what happens at the end of the term. Well, after that meeting, I came to class every week prepared to do battle. Prepared to engage every single soul in that room, including Fraser himself, in vehement discussion on whatever poet or group of poems we were discussing that week. And so I went from being shy and retiring and wallflower to engagé. I was like in there like a dirty shirt every week. And that class, I will say it, honestly, I dominated that class. From that point on, nobody was able to win any arguments with me. And Fraser was sitting there nodding vigorously every week from that point on because then I did write another paper, unofficially, but I wrote it out of the pressure of an argument I was having with one other student about Hopkins. Yeah, it was a paper on Hopkins. And the question was, is Hopkins really obscure or not? And I took the tack that he really wasn't and decided to argue that in what turned out to be a 15-page paper, which was circulated around the members of the class. I know Fraser liked it. I don't know if that influenced his final thinking on my grade, but I will say that when I got that A from him, I knew I had earned it, and I felt very, very good about it. I knew that it said I understood something about examining literature, and especially reading poetry. I felt really, really good about that, and then later on when I was working on While of Falls, he was on sabbatical in 1990 in Mexico, and I sent him the manuscript because I figured I really respected his point of view on things, and I felt that if he liked it, then I had a good book. And he sent me back the manuscript with some suggestions for changes, and it got lost in the mail and never turned up. But he sent me as well a letter where he basically praised the manuscript, and I thought, okay, great. And ever since, he remains a very thorough and tough critic of all of my creative work. And it's one of the nicest things for me, again, was when he came to the opera performance. He'd seen the manuscript many, many, many times. It had made many, many, many critical comments on it, which I tried to take into consideration at different points in writing it. But when he came to the opera last year in Dartmouth, came up to me afterwards and said that he thought it was great. Now, that to me was extremely important because this is somebody who is very sparing with those kinds of accolades and very, very, very severe in his criticism. So I don't know, I'm getting, again, I was all over the place here, but back to 86, 85, 86, as I was getting into the MA program at Dell, I was also still somewhat associated with the Black United Front. And what had happened, this is another thing, at the same time we'd been fighting for this acquittal with the Weymouth Falls Justice Committee, 85, 86, what had happened at the same time was that there was a very conservative leadership of the Black United Front, I mean, even more conservative than usual. And what they had decided to do was they had put a bill before the Nova Scotia legislature to merge the Black United Front with the Black Cultural Center, which had just been founded, started, organized in 1983. It opened its doors for the first time. And all of us who were progressive in the community hated the idea because we knew what was really at stake here was the gutting of the Black United Front as any kind of effective political organization. It already wasn't all that credible as a political organization, but we knew that if it was merged with the Black Cultural Center, it would cease to have any kind of political import. And even worse, the bill that was put before the Nova Scotia legislature was extremely anti-democratic. It was put forward by the Buchanan government. And what the bill would have done is it would have merged these two organizations, but it also, part of the bill also stipulated that all government monies coming into the Black community would be funded through, would be funneled through a new 15-person board of directors who'd be responsible for deciding who would get what funds for any kind of community initiative. And we could imagine what that board was going to look like. A handful of lawyers, a few ministers, a very conservative board of directors, i.e. no more political activism in the Black Nova Scotian community was going to be funded. We knew that. And the people who were running the Black United Front knew that too. They also knew that. The Buff leadership, who were responsible for putting this bill before, getting this bill into the legislature, and it actually made it to second reading. What stopped it? What stopped it was an underground newsletter that a group of us had a hand in putting out.
People.
More than one person thought it was the work of white people.
Oh, who were good
doing
hook.
This. That's right. Yeah, so, anyway, the result of all that was the leadership of Buff was forced to resign, and people who we considered to be more progressive became the new leadership. But with that leadership change, I was then asked to do the official newsletter for the Black United Front, which became The Wrap. And The Wrap then evolved into a little community newspaper that came out once a month. It was 8 pages long. I was the editor. I had an advertising manager by the name of Mark Day, whose father was a sergeant at arms in the Nova Scotia legislature, Buddy Day, first Black sergeant at arms. We managed to break a couple of stories in Halifax. I mean, big stories. Nobody else could get hold of because they were inside the community.